You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our first of two podcasts on metastatic non-small cell lung cancer hosted by Med Learning Group titled Personalized Medicine for Metastatic Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, Leveraging Immune Competence. This series is designed to meet the educational needs of global medical oncologists, oncology nurses, pharmacists, nurse practitioners, and other members of the multidisciplinary team in the community setting to maintain an up-to-date understanding of the latest data on immune checkpoint inhibitor regimens in the management of NSCLC. My name is Kim Farina, a medical director for Med Learning Group, and I will be the host of today's podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking about data from phase 3 clinical trials of first-line immune checkpoint inhibitor-based therapy for metastatic NSCLCs that do not harbor an EGFR or ALK mutation. Joining me today is Dr. Edward Guerin, Professor of Medicine and Hematology Oncology at Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA in Los Angeles, California. Dr. Guerin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with a quick rundown of the standards of care. So for 2024, the NCCN made a few changes to its first-line recommendations, and ASCO also just issued its living guidelines for NSCLC without an actionable driver mutation. Would you give us an update on the current guidelines with respect to advanced metastatic NSCLC? For example, what are the changes in the NCCN guidelines? What are the key takeaways of the ASCO guidelines? And have you noticed any elements of discordance between the two guideline sets?
Yeah, overall, I think that the guidelines are fairly consistent. I think that for the NCCN guidelines, obviously the technology over time progresses. And so with that, we anticipate, over time, there may be new drivers that have approved therapies that would be listed. One other thing, as we've started to have more approaches that are based on RNA testing that can help identify genomic drivers, it's now asked that we consider that. I think the field is still grappling with how to incorporate plasma testing. There are certain cases, obviously, where, for instance, tissue is scant, and there certainly can be utility of plasma. There are also, of course, is literature indicating that there may be benefits to doing both plasma and tissue testing, and that's considered acceptable, certainly. And I think that if we're looking at sort of changes, one of the things that is a little unique is that there was a time, of course, where there were multiple different chemotherapy, immunotherapies, combinations that were being investigated and for which we have data. Now, particularly with the NCCN guidelines, in the chemo-immunotherapy combinations, which is really recommended certainly for patients who have PD-L1 less than 50%, either the group with PD-L1 less than 1% or 1 to 49%, the preferred combinations are pembrolizumab and carboplatin, and a sort of histology specific agent it's generally pemetrexed in non-small cell lung cancer, and a taxane in squamous disease. The NCCN and ASCO call it out a little bit differently, but in the end, it's fairly similar with those two being preferred. There are a group of other approaches that are available, combination of atezolizumab, carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, for instance, combinations that include CTLA-4 inhibitors, either nivolumab and ipilimumab, with or without chemotherapy, or tremelimumab and durvalumab with chemotherapy. Those are recommended, and also in NCCN category 1, they are listed as possibilities in the ASCO living guideline, but they are not in the preferred category. in the greater than 50% ASCO living guideline, for instance, lists the three approved agents in that setting, pembrolizumab, atezolizumab, and cemiplimab, as strong recommendations. The preferred chemotherapy regimens from NCCN are listed as strong recommendations in the group with 1 to 49%. And the guidelines sort of acknowledge that we are not in exactly the sort of place we would want in patients who have PD-L1 less than 1% and don't necessarily assign a strong recommendation there.
Thanks. So you mentioned plasma testing. Would you tell us a little bit about how you're using that?
Sure. So plasma testing, the usage in our practice has maybe changed a little bit. We have worked very hard to put together a process whereby the biopsies are sent really very early to NGS testing. And so oftentimes when I see patients, I actually already have the NGS testing in hand, or will by a few days later, at which point I'll be able to review the NGS testing and then additional imaging that I may have obtained. And under those circumstances, I'm not necessarily getting liquid biopsy. Oftentimes I'm getting all of the information I need from the tissue biopsy and may already be able to design very early a treatment plan. On the other hand, in patients where I'm seeing them from the outside and, for instance, they have not yet had NGS testing, in those cases, oftentimes I will get both liquid and tissue. I think that the issue is that, in general, the liquid biopsies are returning much faster. That can give us really a lot of helpful information. And, of course, there is some data that these are complementary tests that sometimes one will pick up things on liquid biopsy that are not picked up on tissue and vice versa. There also, of course, are a small but real percentage of patients where there is not sufficient tissue and the tissue biopsy fails to meet the standards to return a meaningful result. And although I have seen for some reason that you'll occasionally get some problem with a liquid biopsy, in general, that is quite rare with a liquid biopsy. In general, you may have a result that may be not particularly informative. The sensitivity of these tests are not as good in general as a tissue biopsy. But nonetheless, usually one is able to get a meaningful result from them. Even if that doesn't show anything, it doesn't say quantity not sufficient, for instance, which is a frequent result from a tissue-based NGS testing.
Great, thank you. You also mentioned that cemiplimab was upgraded to a preferred first-line therapy for non-small cell lung cancer. Can you discuss the clinical trial data and developments in the field that led to that change in the guidelines?
Sure. So there really were two main studies with cemiplimab, the Empower Lung 1 and 3. One was looking at patients with PD-L1, which was greater than 50%. Overall, parsing that closely through the data, you can say the data looked pretty similar to what was seen with pembrolizumab in that setting. And the Empower Lung 3 was a chemotherapy plus cemiplimab study. And again, the data seen was fairly similar to what was seen with the KEYNOTE-189 study of carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab. So for the squamous with the taxane substitute out for the pemetrexed, there are a few differences. This was a global study. I don't know that it enrolled in the United States.
Well, thank you, Dr. Guerin. So now we've already discussed cemiplimab. Now let's talk about preferred pembrolizumab and atezolizumab-based therapies, which represent the other preferred frontline options. Would you talk to us a little bit about the latest clinical trial data for pembrolizumab plus doublet chemotherapy and for monotherapy with pembrolizumab or atezolizumab?
The updated data is, you know, is something that we often get. Now, how helpful updated data is, one can argue. I think that when it is at time points that we anticipate evaluating, that can be helpful. I think that when it shows something that maybe isn't what we expect, that also can be helpful. I think first I'll start with the data on patients who have PD-L1 of 50% or greater. Obviously there, we have very encouraging data from pembrolizumab that would indicate that really there is a significant proportion of patients, upwards of 25%, that are going to be alive 5 years out if they receive pembrolizumab in that setting. I think that when one looks at the data from cemiplimab, we do not have as long-term follow-up, but nonetheless, I think that there is reason for enthusiasm based on the data that we see that it will track fairly closely with what has been seen with pembrolizumab. The one in that setting that I think is a little more concerning is the data with atezolizumab, where when we look at the three-year follow-up data, it does not look quite as good as what we've seen with pembrolizumab. We are always concerned in these cross-trial comparisons that we tend to often make too much out of small differences, and that could be the case here. But I think that it is going to be important to follow that data over time to ensure that the long-term data does mirror that of other agents that would be in that preferred category. As far as the chemo-immunotherapy combinations, again, the pembrolizumab combinations have the longest follow-up. And when I look at the follow-up data from those studies, the sort of conclusion that I draw is that these have clearly improved survival in general in a statistically meaningful way. What is unclear to me is whether or not there's anything to argue that we are increasing the number of patients who are alive 5 years out. And I think that's important because that's one of the really exciting things about immunotherapy, this idea that you have a group of patients who is doing extremely well, you know, many years out. And I think that that has maybe, I would argue, been a bit of a disappointment of the chemo-immunotherapy combinations, that although that patients are living longer based on these combinations, it is not clear that it is changing the number of what we would often describe as durable survivors.
So you had mentioned the utility of the data updates, and another thing we see a lot at society meetings are updates from these larger trials where they're looking at subgroups or biomarker analyses. Can you share with community oncologists how you're using those data in your own practice, if at all, or what do you view as the value of those reports?
Sure. So obviously, when one conducts a trial, and of course, I've been involved in many trials over the years, you basically try to conduct a trial in a way that shows something at a level of statistical significance, generally for a primary endpoint like overall survival in the entire patient population, for instance. There are subsets of studies that one can look at. And traditionally, we have described those as hypothesis generating. There are subsets that can be sort of in some ways ridiculous. The one that I often use is the idea of what day of the week they got their first cycle. And in fact, because there are five different choices, and because our threshold for a significant value is set at something happening by chance in one of 20, you know, times, somewhere around one in four studies, you might have a difference based on day of week that the person was treated, but it's hard to imagine that that's really meaningful. These subsets tend to be more meaningful when you tend to have multiple studies, all of which show the same thing. So, for instance, in many of the early studies, the PD-L1 data would have been subsets of this. And I think over time, we've become comfortable with the idea that PD-L1, of course, is important in predicting the likelihood of outcomes. But it's also a difficult thing to determine because One, we know there is some statistical noise. Again, if you look at a million subsets, you'll find some things that do have significance. Also, I think that there's significant risk of sort of overinterpreting the data. And I think that's hard. Also, we tend to then have difficulty separating what in some cases is a prognostic marker from a predictive one. So just back to your biostats 101, a predictive marker is showing the outcome associated with a specific therapy. A prognostic marker is showing outcome just in general. And I think that can sometimes get a little bit messy. So I think that oftentimes it is most helpful when you have multiple data sets all going the same way. But it can be complicated. And I think there's one study that I'll be involved in where we're actually looking at one subset or a few subsets, particularly looking at STK11 and KEAP1 mutations. These have been, they clearly are a poor prognostic group. They have also been listed as a potentially predictive group for poor outcomes from immunotherapy. And there's been some suggestion that CTLA-4 inhibition is of greater efficacy in these populations of patients. I'm happy to be involved in the clinical trial that's actually going to test that because, again, historically, we have found these subset analyses to be hypothesis generating, with the idea being that in an ideal world, we would conduct a randomized study to evaluate the hypothesis that was generated by the subset analyses.
Very interesting. I'm going to switch gears now to talk about maintenance therapy. So once patients receiving an ICI doublet chemotherapy regimen complete their doublet chemotherapy, how are you handling maintenance therapy? For example, how long do you continue immunotherapy for those patients?
So for me, maintenance therapy has been a difficult question to answer because none of the trials have really assessed maintenance therapy. I think if we take a step back, one of the things that's particularly difficult is that we really don't necessarily have, a tremendous scientific basis for the amount of time that we have patients on immunotherapy. So the pembrolizumab studies, you know, stopped at 2 years at some point arbitrarily. Other studies early in the development stopped at 1 year. We did have a randomized study of nivolumab that was a randomized discontinuation study. So in that study, patients who were doing well at a year were randomized to stop nivolumab or continue. And I think the statistical design was not perhaps as rigorous as other studies in which I've been involved. But nonetheless, in the intent to treat analysis, the patients who continued did better than those who did not. Now that was at 1 year. I think that for those who might use 2 years of pembrolizumab, they would say, well, that was 1 year, we do 2 years. Whether or not that's the real distinction or the real lesson of that study, I would argue that it really wasn't a 1 versus 2 year study. It was the value of indefinitely treating. The other really significant question there is how long to continue the pemetrexed. So I think in an era where we've really had substantial advances in immunotherapy as well as in targeted therapy, we tend to forget how substantial we thought the benefit of maintenance pemetrexed was when the original studies of pemetrexed were conducted. And we also tend to dismiss the idea that there are long-term benefiters from chemotherapy. But I do have multiple patients in my clinic who are many, many years into pemetrexed maintenance. In all fairness, they almost never can be on every 3 weeks for years and years and years, but have extended over time and are doing quite well. So I think it becomes a difficult question on the pemetrexed maintenance. I think that is a place where anecdotally, in the absence of data, I have sometimes used things like the PD-L1 expression. If someone has a PD-L1 expression of 90%, that I tend to, you know, they're having a difficult time, for instance, with the chemotherapy over time, with fatigue, things like that. That's a situation where I'd be more likely to stop the pemetrexed. I think that with a PD-1 inhibitor, personally, and this is a bit biased from being part of the early studies where we treated forever and having, you know, many 10-year plus survivors at this point, I have in cases sort of extended treatment beyond 2 years. But also noting that I have some long-term survivors who ended up, particularly because of toxicity, getting less than a year of PD-1 inhibition, but continue to do well. So I think it's a place where we don't have the answers and maybe never will. It's not going to be, nobody's going to be running a study at this point of the value of pemetrexed maintenance. I don't know that we're going to be getting more studies of duration questions. So I think it is a difficult question for practitioners.
Thanks so much for that. So how many patients do you have or do you know of that are surviving 10 plus years after receiving immunotherapy?
So in my practice, we're probably at, I'm thinking the approvals were 2015. Those are the original approvals. So we're not to the point of having any sort of off-trial patients who are out 10 years. In my own practice, I have, at this point, there are four patients from trials, early trials that I follow personally. There are other patients from trials that I was involved with and helped lead that are in that group. But the other thing that I would say that is sort of something we have to remember, and I always describe this as the Guerin number one rule of medical statistics, is that 100% of people will die. That's just how we're designed. And so one of the other things that we've seen, which is meaningful, is that we have an additional substantial number of patients who unfortunately have passed away, but not from lung cancer. And even some of those patients that I have that I mentioned are getting quite old. And so I think that it's important for us to remember that in the end, real success for us is really having somebody end up passing away from something that isn't their lung cancer. And our numbers there are also substantial. Remember, this is often an elderly group of patients that are enrolling. And so there certainly are competing risks. And also because of the smoking history, they're a group that does have higher risk of other causes of death related to pulmonary disease, to cardiovascular disease, or other malignancies.
Despite the overall improvements that we've seen with immune checkpoint inhibitors in lung cancer, patient preferences, goals, and quality of life are often overlooked during treatment selection and during administration. So what are your recommendations for minimizing communication gaps between healthcare providers and patients?
So personally, I don't tend to see a big difference in terms of what the goals are in patients who are receiving frontline immunotherapy. I think that this is a group of patients in whom the patients are very hopeful for deriving long-term benefit from the therapy that they're on. And I think that aligns very closely with what their practitioners want. I also think that this is a setting where if you did have to put a patient in a situation where they would take on greater risk, they generally would be willing to for the potential of long-term benefit. So I think we're in a fortunate position now with the approved regimens where there's not no risk. We still have patients who will have severe pneumonitis or other toxicities, but the risk is fairly low with the upside of therapy being fairly high. I think where this becomes a much bigger question is in the previously treated patient population, the people who have already received an immune checkpoint inhibitor. I think that is a place where it is difficult for us to argue that we have therapies that are going to achieve a durable benefit in that population. And that's where I think it really is important to be really clear with patients, because I think that that it is difficult. And in the United States, one of the things, because we often are able to continue the immunotherapy, and I'm not talking about studies where they're doing that, because there you're collecting data. But outside the context of a study, I think the fact that oftentimes, for instance, somebody who's gotten monotherapy with particularly pembrolizumab and cemiplimab, would be able in many cases to have chemotherapy added on to that, allows us to avoid, unfortunately, the difficult conversation with the patient to sort of explain to them that we think they're unlikely to be the patient who is going to derive long-term benefit from immunotherapy.
That's all the time we have for today. In our second podcast, we'll dive into a discussion of mitigation and management for immune-related adverse events. I would like to thank you, Dr. Guerin, for taking the time to speak with us, and thanks to all of our listeners for joining us. Hopefully, you're able to tune in to the other podcast in this series and explore the many other types of CME programs that MedLearning Group offers. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I'd like to give a special thank you to Regeneron, who provided an unrestricted grant for this educational activity. Have a great day.